Welcome to another episode of What Matters in North Carolina. As always, I'm your host, Matt Calder, and we've got a great show for you today. First, we're going to be talking with Dr. Bob Lipke of the Civitas Institute. We're going to be talking about a couple of his most recent articles that are looking at, you know, identifying and addressing the problem of education in, or higher education, really, in North Carolina. Partially, you know, how we define higher education really is maybe a bachelor's, master's, or doctorate kind of advanced degrees, when there's other higher education models out there for vocational things, apprenticeships, associate's degrees that really kind of don't get counted in some ways. And he'll be digging into the problems with our current system of kind of judging education and kind of show us maybe where we should be going. And then we'll also talk with Alexander Gwynn, who is the development director for the Civitas Institute. He's a first-time guest on the show. He'll be talking about the upcoming CLC, the Civitas' Conservative Leadership Conference. That's going to be happening in the beginning of April, and we'll dig down into that with Alexander Gwynn. And then we're going to listen into a conversation between Francis DeLuca and Susan Myrick, who you've heard on the show before. And they're going to be talking about things going on with judicial redistricting in the state. There's definitely a lot of movement going on with that. And we'll kind of catch an update from them about that as well. And we'll be kind of tuning into their discussion on that. As always, we want to thank our sponsors for the show, the Civitas Institute, and that's North Carolina's conservative voice. And we thank them for all they do, keeping the Freedom Action Network and the show What Matters in North Carolina up on the air. If you're not already following along on our social media, make sure you're doing that on Facebook and Twitter at What Matters NC on Facebook and Twitter. That is at What Matters NC. However, if you want to listen to the show as a podcast, maybe you're hearing it on the radio, maybe you're on the website at freedomactionnetwork.com, which is a very viable way to get the show, and also listen to the archives of the show, but maybe you want to listen to it in the car or more at your leisure. The way to do that is by downloading the podcast, and the best way to do that is by subscribing to the podcast. And to do that, just search What Matters in North Carolina, where you listen to podcasts, whether it's Apple Podcasts or whether you're on an Android device using one of the many Android apps for podcasts. Just search What Matters in North Carolina, and you can subscribe to the show there. But again, also don't forget to go and swing by freedomactionnetwork.com to check out the archives of all those shows that we've already got in the can, recorded, and published out there. There's plenty of great evergreen stuff still there to be listened to. So first up, we're going to hear from Alexander Gwynn. Bob, thanks for coming back on the show and kicking off the new year with us.
It's good to be here, Matt. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. So you've brought us a couple of articles to talk about today. Is that right?
That is right. The last two I wrote are basically on the same topic, but one of them diagnoses a problem that we're all having. The second one provides some solutions. And what we're talking about is actually they're quite popular these days, but they're a temptation to be resisted, and that is free college tuition proposals that are being put forth by a lot of Democrats and a lot of left-leaning politicians across the country. We're going to talk about those, what's wrong with them, and what we can do to solve the problems that we're having.
All right. So that's kind of a high-level look at it, but what are some of those specific...
If we wanted to start out at... what we're looking at, the problem here, we can all agree on, whether we're on the left or the right, that the issue here is that North Carolina and our country needs better educated, better skilled people to fill jobs, you know, to compete in the world economy. We all know that, and the question becomes, what is the best way to do that?
I want to jump in real quick. I like how you talked about, you said, you know, better education, but you didn't just say like everyone needs a master's degree. You said, you put the word skills in there too. And I think that's an important
point. I deliberately did that because we're talking about education. We're talking also about skill building. And it's important because words have meaning. Skills, we're talking about education, we're talking about schooling. All those words are different ways of kind of getting to the same place, but they're different vehicles of getting there. We're talking about how to create a better workforce Some of that is through traditional education. Some of that is through other routes. And that's, you know, that's really the nub of the issue here. How best do we get a better workforce, either through traditional ways or through other non-traditional ways, such as building people's skills, different forms of education, online, competency-based programs, things like that, that are all beginning to emerge in the last 5-10 years and are different ways of helping to educate and train our population. And, you know, right now we're trying to figure out what's the best way to get there.
So education is part of the answer, at least part of the answer, but free education is not the answer. I mean, there's some serious problems with Governor Cooper's plan for free community college education, but education is really is part of the answer.
College education has been a large part of how we've tried to address this issue in the last 40 years. We've had most of our policies have been oriented towards allowing people access to higher education, to community colleges, to four-year traditional colleges and so forth. We have federal financial aid that has supported that, scholarship programs and so forth, and we funneled millions of students into four-year schools, and now we're finding out that it's not necessarily, you know, everything that it was cracked up to be for all majors. There's a lot of people that come out, thousands of dollars in debt, and don't have the job opportunities they thought they would. So it's time to rethink a lot of that. That has been somewhat the national posture. We need a better educated workforce, put people through four-year colleges. That's been the national stance on federal financial aid, et cetera. There's different ways of getting there. Now, what is one of the biggest drumbeats of the left in the last several years has been to reduce the cost of college. These are the proposals that we're talking about. Even in the last presidential campaign, Senator Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton had similar proposals to reduce the cost of a four-year degree. In some cases, make them entirely free. So that may sound great to parents who have, you know, are looking at massive tuition bills, or students, you know, that are contemplating how they're going to pay for all this. But if you stand back and look at the policy and the assumptions behind it, we think it's a terrible decision to go that way.
Right. And I mean, so this is kind of, my question is, how did college get so expensive? I mean, you're talking about a plan to reduce the cost of college, but how did we get where we are, where we're paying tens of thousands of dollars for a degree?
One of the ways that it's gotten so expensive is because we've kind of taken it outside the marketplace. And what I mean by that is, in large part, much of the funding for it for the last 30, 40 years has come from the federal government in the form of student financial aid. What that does is it distorts the true pricing of education. It allows many people to go into school that, because the price is different than what they normally would have had to pay, it distorts or changes price structures. It has allowed many colleges that, you know, without being blunt about it, probably would have gone under had not the advent of financial aid and the ability to access student funds through federal financial aid. It's kept a lot of institutions open that probably would have closed. And it's allowed campuses to kind of forestall on a lot of those important decisions, because I'm not the only one. A lot of people think that the higher education market in this country is overbuilt. And what's kept it what's kept those decisions, those market decisions at bay, has been the influx of billions of dollars. So you asked, why have the costs gone up? Well, they've gone up because the prices are distorted. In other words, if somebody came in and said, you know, I have a $10,000 car out on the lot, but I'm going to give you $7,000 from the federal government. So that price of that car to you is really only $3,000. Mm-hmm. Is that going to influence your decision?
If I can get a $10,000 car for $3,000?
That's right. Or let's ignore. Let's make it even more realistic. A $40,000 car, you know, for say, you know, $10,000. But that's really
hard to ignore.
That's what financial aid does.
But doesn't it inflate the cost of, you know, using the car model? You say this is a $40,000 car, but you know that this giant pot of money is out there for people to finance this, and they're not having to make any kind of harder decisions in a way. So isn't maybe that $40,000 car, maybe it's really a $20,000 car or a $10,000 car?
Well, the prices get distorted, and campuses, if you look at the price of, you know, the average cost of a four-year tuition and board in schools, they know because of these distortions, they know that they can, in a lot of ways, get away with increasing, you know, the charge of tuition and the charge of room and board. Now, they'll never come out and say that, but the reality is the largest chunk of money in these equations is coming from the government, not from individual students in most cases. It's coming from the government. So that money eventually gets to the institution. Well, if you know that money is going to be there all the time, that's going to change how you operate campuses.
It's going to change your budgeting. I mean, look at a state body and their budgets when they know they can get away with more of this. They know they don't have to be as frugal. They're not like you and me, you know, at the end of the month, if our numbers don't line up, we can be in a tough spot. Whereas the universities don't seem to be in that same position. The you know, state governments aren't in that same position.
So that's right. And so you asked what has contributed to the increase in costs. And student financial aid is by far the largest contributor. But also, there's been a massive increase in what we'll call it administrative bloat in campuses. You know, some of that's driven by more research on individual campuses, which has spawned, you know, compliance offices. They've brought in, you know, institutes and so forth. More non-instructional, but non-instructional. They have a research focus that's gonna add additional staff. But you've also had, you know, you have to comply with more federal regulations, diversity regulations, civil rights compliance. Technology is also a big presence on campus. All those efforts that the federal government now has its tentacles into, they hire administrative staff to make sure that colleges and universities are in compliance. So that all adds additional staff. It raises cost structures, and as we all know, bureaucracies grow over time, and with that, you know, with more federal financial aid, more administrators on campus, the cost of colleges and universities has gone up commensurately.
All right, so what's the fix? Are there a few fixes? I mean, what where do we go from here?
Well, the fix, in my view, is to stand back and say stop. You know, first of all, and we got to tell people why this is a flawed concept. And I think we talked a little bit about that before, and saying how the assumptions behind these proposals are flawed in that college is not necessarily the proxy for talent. You know, it's not an automatic card to the middle class anymore. I'm in favor of targeting, you know, aid programs on programs such as nursing or engineering or so forth that, you know, we are in need of, you know, that there are jobs for, and that, you know, there's no question that it's not going to be subject to these occupations aren't going to be subject to a 5-year swoon all of a sudden, and we don't have need for engineers or nurses in the next 5 years. Those are pretty solid, you know, in some cases, like math or science teachers, that there's a, you know, that's been chronic shortages for. But what we've done is, you know, we haven't focused those. We have.
Right. They're available to anybody. To anyone. I mean, you can get a degree in philosophy or liberal arts.
That's right.
And get the same federal loan benefits and ability to use those programs that the person getting the needed job gets.
So we have to do a good job of saying, you know, we haven't targeted that very well at all. The other issue is, secondly, we have to expand the definition of educated. It has to be defined more, not just a 4-year degree, but also to include apprenticeship programs that are very valuable and oftentimes can be the gateway for people in very good occupations that we need workers in now. And I'm glad that those areas are finally coming to the fore, that I think people on both sides, Democrats and Republicans, can agree that those are some of the areas that we can focus on and develop. And I think that'll provide avenues for kids to go in and, you know, help improve their job prospects and be contributing members of society. Those are two options. The other option is to realize, you know, that there are different, that there are new forms of education, such as there's a lot of talk on what's known as competency-based education now. If anybody who's seen television, and I think in the last month or something, you've probably seen commercials for what's advertised as Western Governors University.
Yeah, I've seen the billboard on the way into work this morning.
This isn't a plug as much as it is kind of regarded now as, I mean, it's a school that's based on that model of competency-based education, which means at the end of a program or at the end of each class and so forth, they're tested on, you know, specifically on what skills they can demonstrate, as opposed to in the traditional colleges, you know, you have seat time for 4 years and then you may have a thesis or some sort of testing, but it doesn't necessarily prove competency. So that's actually becoming quite popular. Programs like that, competency-based learning, are becoming more popular nationally. And that, those areas, online learning, in fact, that might be one of the areas, even within the community colleges. The problem specifically, and we didn't talk about this, but I wanted to make this point, with regards to community colleges, why we're not on board this proposal necessarily, is because there already are programs in place that at the state and federal level that allow high school students and community college students to access college tuition college programs.
Yeah, I use those programs.
Yes, right.
I completed my entire first year of college in high school.
There you go.
I entered with 33 credits towards my communication degree.
And
communications and psychology and a couple of electives.
Okay. So then you know well what we're talking about.
Oh, yeah.
They already exist. Now, it's also based, the whole program is based on the assumption, in my view, that advocates look at the problem and say, okay, the problem is access. And if we could just improve access, we'd lessen the problem of skilled workers. Well, the problem at the community college level, if you look at the data, is that kids drop out. And they don't drop out for financial reasons. They drop out a lot of times for life events. Mm-hmm. Like, they had a baby. Or they took the semester off because they needed to, you know, care for an ailing parent or mm-hmm. they had to change jobs or something. It's not necessarily related to finances. And this whole proposal is based on the notion that it's financial. It's not. The other problematic thing is that there's a high dropout rate here. And if we just continue to throw dollars that way at a program where if we don't correct that, we're just filling a leaky bucket, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So those are the problems. Yes, we can agree that we need a way to get a better educated population, a more skilled population. The question is, what's the best way to do that? We believe that the best way to do that is by not only aiding traditional college, but also expanding it and showing that there are different ways. Competency-based education, online instruction, apprenticeship programs, things like that should be valued. We should encourage and show that there are different routes to get there than just one.
I mean, that's something that you and I recognize in myself. My first thought, you say, you know, get an education. Get, you know, the idea is you go to college, you get a good job, and I think 4-year degree. But there's so many other ways out there to get an education. And I often think about that sort of thing, about like, there's more than one way to skin a cat, and there's other ways to get the education you need to be successful in life.
That's what we're trying to show. And I think that's a really important point that we all need to realize. And there's more than one way to get there.
Oh yeah. Well, thanks for coming on the show, Bob.
Thank you, Matt.
Alexander, thanks for coming to the show. I'm not sure we've had you on before, have we?
I don't think so.
At least not while I've been, you know, right up front and center, I guess.
Nope. I don't think you have.
And so it must be a special occasion to get you out in front of the microphone.
Well, I mean, yeah, I guess it's a special occasion. I mean, this is certainly an exciting time of year. Whenever we have the Conservative Leadership Conference coming up, and we do. So, I have the privilege here at Civitas of putting that conference together along with some of my colleagues here, and it'll be April 13th and 14th, so we're getting pretty close.
Yeah, it's coming up, and I mean, so the Conservative Leadership Conference, I mean, a lot of people who are listening already know what it is or have some familiarity with it, but just kind of what's the 10-second pitch or the elevator pitch of what is CLC or what is the Conservative Leadership Conference?
So, sure, a good way to describe the CLC is it's a crash course on conservative ideas, I think is a good way to put it. I think people in North Carolina are not only looking for a better understanding of what's happening in their own state government, but they're looking for ways to get involved, to be informed, and understand the issues a little better. So the Conservative Leadership Conference has been around since 2008. And every year we try to do it bigger and better and bring in speakers from all over the country, from organizations around the country, and really put some meat on the bones of conservative ideas and give people ways to get involved and defend what they already believe.
Yeah, and I think that's probably a good way to put it. I mean, I've been through a couple of these now with Civitas, and a crash course in information is kind of a good way to put it. I think it's like maybe 60% information download, 30% kind of getting fired up and interacting and networking, and like maybe 10% sleep and eating. maybe at least when we're there.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I certainly at the end of the conference, people are worn out, but I think it's that good type of worn out, you know?
Oh yeah. It's going to be the same place it was last year, right? It was over at the Crabtree Marriott in North Raleigh.
Yep, that's right. And I'll just mention that. So we had it last year at the Crabtree Marriott, and was a great event. And part of that was because the venue was fantastic. The Crabtree Marriott, they just did a massive renovation, so it's a beautiful venue with excellent service, and the rooms at the conference are affordable and really nice. So we're excited to go back there and have another great conference.
All right. So, also, we were talking a little before the show about the outline for how things are going to go on. And then things were a little different last year from years previous in kind of the scheduling of how the conference is going to go. And you're doing that same thing again this year, right?
We are.
So what is that?
Sure. So last year, the way the conference worked is we mentioned how people are totally worn out. In the past, we've done 1 day conferences, we've done 2 full day conferences or separate days. What we did last year was we started out the day on Friday afternoon, late afternoon, and the big event of the day on Friday was our main dinner, our Friday evening dinner, where we give out what we called the Civitas Audentia Award, which is for Audentia is Latin for courage and boldness, and we give that award every year to a private citizen who has gone out of their way to fight for freedom in North Carolina. And that is where we have our headline speaker, and it's just a wonderful event on Friday. And then Saturday rolls right into our breakout sessions and our main stage sessions. And so we'll have a full day on Saturday of speakers from around the country and breakout sessions, training sessions. And that's how the schedule will go.
All right. So that's the schedule we're going to be dealing with. And I mean, that from my experience of just doing a few of these, I thought it was a great way to do it. I thought it was a really good way to get that peak energy out of people in a lot of ways. You get to, you know, you're talking about, it's not a one night event. It's not, you get to keep kind of get that momentum and keep it.
It's just enough.
Oh yeah.
It's just enough. So you're not totally falling down at the end of the day, but you're also excited and energized by the time you walk out the door on Saturday afternoon.
Right. And I mean, just, I also kind of wonder, like in past events, when you go to these conferences that are like 3 days or like 2 really full days, I wonder how many people end up like just ducking a session and just going to the room and trying to recharge a little bit.
Yeah.
And can we avoid that, you know, with CLC the way it is now?
Yeah, I mean, I think that happens a lot. I have certainly done that. I've been to a lot of conferences around the country, and obviously the CLC is my favorite. But certainly, you go all day and you're sitting in a room, and if you're going session after session after session for days and days, it's hard to sustain that. So I think the way that we have it set up is a really good way to do it. And like you said, maximizes the benefit you can really get from it, because we can only remember so many things. We will, however, be putting all the sessions, we'll be videotaping all the sessions, putting them up on the web, the general sessions and the breakout sessions. And so you'll be able to view them after the fact. So, you know, if you're at the event and you decide you need a little break, you'll be able to catch up later on online.
All right, but I mean, and that's a great thing. I don't think that's really happened before, has it?
What's that?
Putting everything online afterwards.
You know, it's always a challenge. You know, technology is a good thing when it works, and it's a nightmare when it doesn't. But we have an excellent videographer lined up this year, and I think we'll have no problem getting everything up and online.
All right, that's a good thing, but I mean, definitely you think people, you know, there's a difference being there,
I think
for sure, being there, talking to these speakers, and speaking of speakers, are you going to give us a little taste of who's going to be around? Is that available yet? Can I pull that out of you?
Yeah, well, I'd love to give you a little more information, but I think for right now, you're just going to have to trust me. We haven't announced any speakers yet, and that is why we've got early bird tickets up. So tickets are less expensive right now, and in fact are less expensive than last year even. And I think the people who buy the tickets now are the ones that know that Civitas puts on a great event, and the majority of our people do buy our early tickets. And as soon as we really, pretty soon after we start releasing speakers, those tickets are going to rise because tickets start to sell. So, yeah, I'm going to hold off for now. But as soon as we start releasing speakers, you'll know.
Where can people go and buy these tickets?
Well, you need to visit www.civitasclc.com. So let me spell that out. It's C-I-V-I-T-A-S-C-L-C.com. civitasclc.com. Or if you prefer, you can give us a call at 747-8061. That's 919-747-8061. And we'll be happy to get you signed up and look forward to seeing you at the conference.
Okay, so buy the early bird ticket and you'll get in at the bottom floor. You'll get the lowest possible price to really get this stuff. But you can't tell me, even if I you know, go and we lower these mics down for just a minute, I can't get the exclusive information.
Well, I might tell just you.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we'll how about after the segment?
Yeah.
And then we'll probably have you back on maybe before the announcement comes out and I'll give my very cryptic opinion on whether it's worth the price of the early bird. Maybe that'll be how it goes.
Yeah. Well, that sounds good. I'd be happy to come back on and talk about speakers, definitely.
All right. So we touched some of the high points. I think that every year that the conference has sort of a building block idea, a tagline, a theme. I mean, what is that decided and concrete, set in stone now?
Yeah, absolutely. So you're right. Every year we build the conference off of a central theme. And this year is a little bit different for a couple of reasons. Number one is Civitas has recently, we've gone back and thought about how we can be the most effective organization. And part of doing that was reformulating our mission statement and how we can communicate what we do and what we believe. And what we ended up with was a mission statement that says, "The Civitas Institute fights to eliminate barriers to freedom so that all North Carolinians can live a better life." And coincidentally, we just passed the 30th anniversary of Reagan's speech to tear down this wall, the Berlin Wall.
Right, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, everybody knows that. And so we thought that was a special year and a kind of nice confluence of events. And so the theme is built around this idea of obstacles to freedom, government obstacles to freedom, and what we can do to eliminate them. What we can do as organizations, as individuals, and communities to tear down those barriers.
All right. So, I mean, that's you only get one shot at that, though. You building off of your the new mission statement to build the conference around that idea. I guess you better make sure you're aiming right.
Well, I mean, I think we are. I think there's a lot of things that we could do as an organization and at this conference in particular, but I really think as the Civitas Institute, we need to be focusing on the things that we can do to make people's lives better. And in our case, that's identifying obstacles to freedom and doing everything we can to get rid of them. And so this year, what we'll do around that theme, we're gonna focus on a couple of things. And the first one is gonna be, since we're not talking about physical barriers like Ronald Reagan was, it's important for us first to identify what the obstacles are, what those obstacles are to North Carolinians pursuing the American dream as they see fit. So, they come in the form of high taxes and overregulation. They come in the form of occupational licensure. They limitation on school choice and all sorts of other things. So the first step is identifying what the problem is. And so we'll be talking about where those obstacles are and what we need to do to address them. Another thing we'll do following that is to teach folks the skills to become better advocates for liberty. So first identify the skills and then tell people how they in their own lives and in their own families and neighborhoods can work to eliminate those barriers. So it's not just Civitas doing it. It's all of us coming together. It's conservatives working together and working effectively to impact what's happening in Raleigh.
All right. And we've kind of got to close this one out, but I wanted to touch on one more thing before we got out of here. And this is a big conference in a way, because there's a leadership change going on at the Civitas Institute right now that's been announced. And this will be the first CLC under new leadership of incoming Civitas Institute President Donald Bryson. Mm-hmm. Of course, Donald Bryson coming from lead state director at AFPNC.
Yep.
So this will be a sort of his coming out ball for the Civitas Institute, you know, for your people, you know, your the people who come to this conference every year. This will be sort of a
it'll be an introduction.
Yeah.
And I think I can think of no better way to introduce Donald to the folks that come to the CLC than to do it at the CLC. So Colonel DeLuca has led Civitas for the past 10 years and done an excellent job, built Civitas and the CLC to what it is today. And we're all very excited to have Donald coming aboard and leading us through this year's CLC. So you'll certainly, if you come and get your tickets, you'll certainly see plenty of Donald and hear from him and hear his ideas for Civitas and for North Carolina. So, it'll be a little bit different, but change is good. And Donald comes from a close friend organization of Civitas, Americans for Prosperity, North Carolina, has done a great job there, and we're excited to have him come aboard here and speak at the conference, certainly.
All right. Well, thank you, Alexander.
Yep, absolutely.
This is Francis DeLuca, president of Civitas Institute, and I'm here with Susan Myrick, election policy analyst. Susan?
Hello, Francis.
How are you doing?
I'm good.
Well, once again, we're here to talk about redistricting, but we're not just going to be repeating because in the next 2 weeks, a bunch of stuff may be happening. So why don't you go ahead and tell us why is this important now?
Well, there's a couple of things, actually. One old we've heard about before, but it's moving into a new phase, and one relatively new on the scene. The first one is a court case that goes by the name of Covington versus North Carolina, and that is concerning the legislative districts. This case is requiring that the legislature redraw legislative districts, and they've already done that and gone back to the court, and right now where it stands is the court has decided that they don't want the legislature to do their constitutional duty, and they have selected an outsider. They call him a special master. That's supposed to be an expert, and this outsider from Stanford University has drawn a new map, or two, one for the House and one for the Senate, the state districts.
And not to interrupt you, but it's important to the court never found or never said what was wrong with the district.
Right? And that is probably the most troubling thing. When the legislature offered their new maps, the court never did make any specific comments as to those maps. They just said, no, you know what, we're going to bring in an outsider in to do this. I believe they're pushing the so-called nonpartisan
model.
Commission model and wanting that to be a precedent in North Carolina, which is, you know, another story altogether. It's unconstitutional as far
according
as
to the North Carolina
according
Constitution.
The North Carolina Constitution. But anyway, so what's going to happen? The court has not budged as far as timing. The legislature, the attorney for the legislature, wanted to move along at a faster pace because they know if this special master plan wins out that they will take this case to the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court. So anyway, on Friday, on the 5th of January, they will be back in federal district court talking about the maps that the special master have created for our legislative districts. And that's where we are with legislative districts.
And we should add that the defendants in this case, which is the legislature,
that's
and
right.
the people of North Carolina,
that's right.
who are defending their legally drawn districts,
that's right.
have hired another expert witness who has already analyzed the districts that the special master drew and has said those districts used race in the drawing of it. He said his analysis showed that they used race, which is completely opposite of what the court was saying. The problem was that
the state used race too much. And so when the state went back to draw their map, they said they did not even look at race.
Right.
And I think their hope is using that tactic, that when they go before the Supreme Court, they can grab that one justice that voted against them last year, which is Justice Clarence Thomas. And the only reason he voted against them in that one case was he doesn't believe you should look at race at all.
Right. He's one who believes we should be race neutral, that people should not look at color. We should be
looking at voters.
Right.
So that's where we are with the legislative redistricting. The newest story out there.
Well, on the legislative, I believe that they'll go to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is going to side with the state.
I believe
that they may not only side with the state, but I wouldn't be surprised to see them do a rebuke of the Fourth Circuit and this court for what they've done.
They actually have already rebuked the district court for last year. The district court wanted them to redraw the districts in 2017 and have a legislative election in 2017.
Right, and the
Supreme Court was not happy with that, and they put a kibosh on that and stopped it. And so we're at the next stage here. I agree with you. I think it will definitely go to Supreme Court. Phil Strack, the state's lawyer, indicated that. I think that's the only place it can go to. And I do believe that they will side with North Carolina. And whether they take us back to the districts that...
I think they'll take it, if I had to guess, they'll take it back to the districts that this court threw out. So basically they'll say, look, they redrew the districts. We're happy. Just go with those and hold the election.
I think that's a happy compromise. But then now.
Now, there's another.
To the newish. It's newish. It's old news that nobody ever has talked about in 50 years or so. But I want you to, if you don't mind, to talk about the news story on judicial redistricting and reforms.
Well, it really started last year when the legislature started talking about redrawing the maps for everything below statewide judges. And when we say that, we're talking about Superior Court, District Court. We're also talking about judicial districts, like for district attorney and stuff. What's happened over years, the North Carolina court system was built about, in its modern form, 50-plus years ago. And they drew all these districts. I think the district court, in fact, we're celebrating 50 years of the district court being in existence, and district courts, superior courts, prosecutors, DAs, all that was drawn. And then we've basically not redone anything since then. We did some stuff about 25, 30 years ago in response to a court case that said you've got to make these districts more equal. But we didn't really change it very much. So what they're saying is it's time to redistrict. It's time to change the shape of these districts because they don't really represent the population as it exists now.
Which the population has changed quite
dramatically
in 50 years.
And what's happened is there's a lot of screaming and shouting because over the years, those districts have changed. They have not stayed static. We have added judges, we've added DAs, and what would happen is a powerful legislator would say, hey, they wouldn't say this, but they'd have a friend who wanted to be in the court, or they'd have a friend who wanted to be DA, or the local area wanted another judge. So they'd add a district, but they were the ones drawing it. So no one complained about that. It happened time and time again. That's why you have these judicial districts that are A and B, prosecutorial districts A and B. They're not all just, what they used to be because they've split them up and everything. So they've changed. But the difference now is that the Republicans in charge want to take a holistic look at the courts and redraw everything at the same time. Not getting rid of them, just redraw them, make them all more equal, make everything more uniform. And suddenly, the Democrats and liberals are screaming bloody murder. And that's because In the past, it was always them drawing it.
Right.
Now, it's the Republicans who will draw it, and they're somehow that is wrong when they were doing it all these years.
This is kind of deja vu all over again. If you, I don't remember all the way back there, but if you've read about redistricting for congressional districts, that's exactly what the Democrats did all those years leading up to 1965 and the Voter Rights Act. They never redistricted. They just would go in and
tweak it.
And until, so when the VRA came into being, they were required, and they started redistricting in earnest, in 1970. But, and as you know, after that, that's when the lawsuit started. But
yeah,
and it's the same story.
It's the same, exactly. It's just a different, it's the same tune, but different song.
Right.
And so now the interesting thing about this is we've kind of got a couple things coming up on this, the judicial thing. So we've got the redistricting part, but there's another move to possibly stop electing our judges, at least initially, turn it into an appointment of some kind. Who knows what that looks like, but that would actually take a constitutional amendment. We've already put off the filing date for in no primary for judicial offices because I think the legislature hopes they can change
the way that judges are elected.
We should probably stop saying elected because there is a move in the legislature to make it selected, and I am against that.
I'm against that, too.
I think we ought to keep electing our judges.
I believe the people do a good job in the end. If they have all the information that they need about an appointment, and that's what we've been working on for the last 6 years, is getting that partisan label back on the ballots.
And we finally got it.
And we got it back on the ballots. And it was just more information that voters need about the judges they select. And of course, the left knew in the 1990s that partisan label was hurting them because most voters think Republican, or at least at the time, Republican judges were law and order judges.
Right. They would follow the law.
That's what they wanted, and that's how they would vote. And so when the left decided, ooh, that partisan label's hurting us, they started taking it off the ballots, and we've just got it back on for all of the judgeships.
In fact, there are people who credit Donald Trump being elected president with that Supreme Court vacancy.
Absolutely.
That a lot of people said, if for nothing else, they wanted a Republican to fill that vacancy, which tells you about how people view the courts and who puts people on the courts and what kind of people serve on the courts. But now, so back to this. So they're coming in, and the truth is we don't have a clue what's going to happen in the coming weeks on judicial.
But they're supposed to come back in on the 10th, which is next Wednesday.
So we've got the 5th and the 10th as being major dates.
Of something might happen in redistricting, but what we don't know.
And or in changing the way we select our judges.
Right.
So I think we'll find out fairly rapidly if they make a move to reinstate a primary for judicial races, that they're not going to do anything to change the selection. Doesn't mean they won't change the districts,
which is something that is much needed.
Yeah. So let's hope if they don't, that they at least get those districts changed, because I agree with it. You know, nobody knows who they're voting for judge till they walk in. And the fact is that, you know, there are some places where you elect two judges out of a district and some where you elect one. And
right.
So that's a kind of the update on redistricting in terms of both the legislative.
For now, I counted up four major legislative and congressional lawsuits for the 2010-2011 redistricting. They were a combination of cases, and there's still a case or two, you know, sitting off to the side. So if Covington v. North Carolina doesn't make the left happy, they've got a couple of lawsuits ready to push forward. So lawsuits are here to stay, I think. I think it's something that we've gotten used to almost.
Well, thank you. You've been listening to Susan Myrick, election policy analyst for Civitas, and this is Francis DeLuca, president, and we hope to be talking to you again soon.
Well, thank you to Francis for coming on the show, and Susan as well. And of course, thank you to you, the listeners, for coming on the show and Catch you next time.